Welcome to another podcast in our series for the International Chamber of Commerce UK branch. This is ICC's World Business Podcast recorded in London on Tuesday, 13th February 2018. Today I'm joined by Chris Southworth, Secretary General of the ICC United Kingdom, Rob Mulligan, Senior Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs at the USCIB, and Jean Blaylock, Coordinator at the Trade Justice Movement and Policy Advisor at Global Justice Now.
There's some interesting dialogue going on over on the UK side here about, you know, creating trade models that work for everyone. So, Rob, from a US perspective, how do you think we can create a trade model that works for everyone, for government, business, NGOs, unions, and civil society?
Well, thanks, Chris. It's not an easy question, but, I think you have to keep in mind trade investment are critical drivers for economic growth in most countries, and so traditionally the process has been for trade agreements to focus on removing barriers to trade so companies can expand business employment. But as if governments are going to now look at more than, you know, what can they do through trade that's beyond this and need to balance the interests of all the groups that you're talking about, they have to improve the consultation process with them and, figure out how are they going to try to balance all these different concerns. But I guess I would also note that, it can't be just all on the trade agreements. I think for them to, be effective, it's going to be important for governments to be implementing supporting policies that provide the training, the financial support, the infrastructure, and incentives that are key to sort of making sure that the benefits of economic growth that come from trade are shared by as many as possible.
The U.S. model is often sort of used as a reference when talking about sort of structured consultation systems. There are obviously pros and cons of the U.S. model, but can you just explain how the consultation process works within the U.S. and how that ties into Congress? And from your experience, what works, what doesn't, where would you see room for innovation?
Yeah. Well, the U.S. system has several layers for consulting on trade, and then the first is probably the Trade Promotion Authority, where Congress has passed a law that requires the administration to consult closely with the Congress as they're developing the trade agreements, and part of that is a trade-off for an agreement that when the final agreement comes up for approval by Congress, then it's an up or down vote. There's not efforts to amend the agreement during, in Congress. So that's part of that trade-off. We also have a system of official advisory committees that have representatives from business, labor, civil society, and these people have what's called security clearance that allows them to be able to see negotiating texts and provide advice to the administration and the U.S. Trade Representative as they're negotiating. One example of that is the advisory committee to the president, and that includes business company CEOs, the head of the AFL-CIO for labor, and representatives from other stakeholder groups. We also then have a process for a Federal Register notice, which goes out publicly and invites comments from anyone who's interested to provide input to the government on that. And I would just add that from my own experience, USTR, the Trade Representative's Office, has, usually meets with a wide range of people, outside groups, to brief them and hear their views during the negotiating process. In some cases, you may recall when they were negotiating the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, they'd have, day-long stakeholder days during the negotiating session. So while they're negotiating, they would take a day off to have presentations from interested parties on their views on the process, the negotiation. So we feel that there's been a lot of levels of consultation through the U.S. process. In terms of maybe something innovation, I'm not sure. It seems to me that maybe as technology is evolving and the way people communicate is evolving, that there will be opportunities for governments to utilize this new technology to improve their exchange of information and between governments and stakeholders as they're pursuing the trade negotiations. But in the end, I guess I would just note that, the governments still have to make the hard choices about balancing you know, what they're hearing from all the different stakeholders and deciding where they want to come out on these trade agreements.
Well, thanks very much. Jean, I'm just going to move to you. I mean, the trade justice movement has done a lot of very good work, I think, in terms of exploring what an alternative trade policy would look like, an alternative trade model. Listening to Rob there, it's striking how much of what Rob's described doesn't actually exist in the UK. It's much more informal. It's much more ad hoc. There are no advisory groups or committees or anything of that kind of nature where stakeholders can feed in. From an NGO perspective, what do you think needs to change, and what do you think is the opportunity on trade policy?
What you're just saying is right about the lack of structures and procedures in the UK, and it is really important because I think it needs to become clearer the way that modern trade deals nowadays actually affect a whole range of areas of everyday life. they affect not just sort of jobs and work and opportunities, but environmental standards, healthcare systems, food safety, all of these sorts of things that we normally think of as just part of more domestic policy are actually strongly impacted by trade. So it's something that affects a lot of people, a lot of groups. And therefore, it's also something that needs to be part of a wide debate with a lot of input from different communities, different interest groups. We did some analysis looking at the figures of meetings that ministers with the Trade Department here in the UK have been having, and 90% of their meetings were with business, and most of those were with big business. So actually, even small businesses, local enterprises and so forth, are not really getting a voice heard in trade policy. And it leads, I think, to a very skewed perspective and an understanding of the impacts of trade deals. We're living in a world of increasing inequality, of a lot of fears around a race to the bottom on standards, and anger even around the failures of globalization and the current model of a way of doing things like trade agreements. And we need to actually address that and look at what has gone wrong, what has not worked, who has been losing out consistently. We need to include those voices and have them be part of the debate. But one area where I think I might sort of come at this slightly differently is the consultation processes are necessary, and we need to sort of set up better ways of doing that. But it's not just around sort of a voluntary stakeholder engagement sort of approach. We also need to have, certainly in the UK, much clearer accountability of trade policy to Parliament and to our democratic processes. I mean, just hearing it's clear, looking at the way that we do trade in the UK at the minute, it's clear that we haven't updated our procedures really in the last 40 years because it has been something that has been the responsibility of the EU. And over those 40 years, the EU has gradually changed the way that it's done things, often as a result of public pressure. It's made changes, it's adapted. From our point of view, we would think, you know, there's a lot more that it could be doing, but at least it has become more transparent. There's become a little bit more level of accountability. The European Parliament gets a vote on trade deals. Yet when we look back at coming back in the Brexit context, looking at what we would have in the UK for an independent trade policy, we don't even get an automatic vote for Parliament on trade deals. And that is actually a really important aspect of ensuring that this wide range of voices should have some kind of connection to and be heard in trade policy. It's also the need for transparency and a much more openness about trade policy. Because it's trade policy sometimes treated as though it's some commercially sensitive negotiation between private parties. It's not. It's a matter of public policy. And I think there's a need to switch our assumptions from what I feel tends to be the assumptions amongst trade negotiators, that everything should be secret unless it's specifically decided not. But instead, it should just be standard that materials and processes are open unless there is a specific reason why it needs to be confidential and secret. I mean, in general, I think it's important for us to have a real debate about what trade policy is for, what the objectives of our trade policy need to be. Are we seeking to tackle the growing inequality in our society? And if so, how do we do that? I mean, I would totally agree with what Rob just said, that it's not all on trade agreements, and actually maybe even turn that round a bit. Actually, a lot of those decisions about what we need to be doing are part of other areas of public policy making. And what trade policy needs to do is to actually support the decisions that are being made in other areas of public policy about how we can create a fairer, more equal society, how we can protect the environment, how we can tackle climate change. All of these things need to be built into trade policy from the start.
I mean, I think we'd agree with pretty much everything you've said, actually. I mean, Rob, do you want to have any? Do you want to come back with any comment or anything that Gene said on any of those issues?
You know, at the end there, I mean, what you were saying. I mean, we've said that clearly there's a lot of domestic policies that impact, you know, how the benefits of economic growth are distributed within a country. So those are important, and you can't put. Sometimes a little too much of the burden is sort of perceived as being on the trade negotiations, and it's really a lot of those other supporting policies that are going to be the real key part to trying to generate the benefit that will address some of the concerns people have raised about trade.
So, you know, in this increasing kind of talk about, you know, the need for a trade model that works for everyone, there seems to be some very common issues, particularly across the G7 countries, where there are these disparities in existence, winners and losers from the last 20 years of trade. I mean, who's doing this right? Who should we look to as an exemplar? Maybe, Gene, if I start with you, which countries would you look at as an ideal model?
Well, I suppose there's two angles to this. There's one concern that, that I've been looking at quite a lot recently, simply because within the UK we have a bill going through Parliament on trade and looking more at the procedures of how we do trade. And for the UK, I mean, as I've said, our procedures are just sort of, it's like we have 40-year out-of-date plumbing and we just need to update the plumbing in some ways. And in that case, I think there's good practice that we can learn from a lot of different places with some commonalities. For instance, you know, the basic fact that in both the EU and the US, the US Congress, the European Parliament, automatically get an affirmative vote on trade policy, whereas we don't have that in the UK. In the EU, before a trade negotiation starts, there needs to be a scoping exercise, an impact assessment's done. In the US, as Rob mentioned, there's a requirement to have a period of consultation within which people can make submissions before a negotiation starts. All of these are good practices that I think we could pick up and try and bring together in the UK and try and put together something that's actually a much more modern and cutting-edge approach to a democratic approach to doing trade. Then, of course, there's actually what we put in our trade deals. And here, I mean, we may well have slightly different opinions, but what matters is to actually be able to have a discussion about this. So I think it's important to, for instance, exclude public services from trade deals. Public services are about how we want to shape our society, not about commercial trade, and they don't belong in a trade deal. I think it's important to try and put something into trade deals to make clear a level that trade deals need to respect human rights law, environmental law, labor law, all of these areas, and if there is some conflict, that those other areas should take precedence over the rules within a trade deal, because this has been an area where you get conflicts. And it has tended to be that trade agreements can override other areas of law. So I think it's important that we should start doing trade in a different way that says, actually, there are some things that are more important. I also particular issues such as something called ISDS, which is Investor State Dispute Settlement, which allows companies to sue governments over areas of public policy that they disagree with. This, I think, is a mechanism that has no place in trade deals and modern society and shouldn't be included. So those are some ideas.
Okay. There's a lot to go out there. Rob, obviously, you would obviously advocate for the kind of U.S. system, I'm assuming. But if you were to cast more broadly beyond U.S. shores, and if we just discount Europe for a minute, as Jean's mentioned, some good practice going on there, where else would you look around the world for exemplars?
Well, I'm not as familiar with the other areas. That's the problem. So I was going to actually, Chris, agree with, in terms of the process stuff, with what Jean had said. I think that the U.S. model provides, you know, a fair amount of opportunity for all stakeholders to share their views with government, and the Congress is actively engaged with the process. I think we just saw, you know, when they were we were in the process of negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which obviously had other situations with the new administration, but in the process of negotiating, it seemed to do a good job of consulting with a wide range of stakeholders and was able to reach, an agreement with a large number of companies, countries at a time when we're having, you know, some challenge on reaching multilateral types of agreements. So we thought that is a good sign. And I think, as Jean said, the EU process, again, not as familiar with it, but it appears to do a good job of reaching out across various interest groups to get and consider views as it pursues trade agreements. And I guess I would mention the WTO, World Trade Organization. It's had some trouble in recent years, but, I mean, it did find a way to move forward on negotiations such as the Trade Facilitation Agreement, which was a significant agreement that will benefit developing and developed countries and really, I think, benefit a lot of the stakeholders that you have mentioned, Chris. So that's a couple of different places to look. In terms of the content, obviously I might take a different view from Jean on some of the things and approaches to the content of the trade agreements. I mean, I think one of the challenges we find as we start trying to consider a lot of different other policies is countries that use those policies to basically as protectionist measures to block out trade, and so there's a real question of where that leads in terms of ultimately, do you end up with really opening trade and improving the opportunities for economic growth, or do those negotiations then become overwhelmed by the various other policy considerations that she mentioned? Also, we would take a different view on ISDS. We don't think it's a case of companies suing when they don't agree with a policy. It was only a case where policies think unfairly appropriate their property or violate the agreements that have been reached between governments. So we think ISDS is important, again, element of encouraging companies to invest in countries and protect their interests when they do invest in countries. So we would have a different approach and view on some of those issues.
So last question. I mean, it seems that there's some areas of opportunity here. I mean, it seems from what you're both saying there's a need for more dialogue between stakeholders. What do you say, Jean? Let's start with you. What are the key areas of opportunity, if you were to name one or two areas that we should be working on immediately? What would they be?
Well, I mean, I suppose here in the UK, very focused in a sense on the discussions around trade that are happening as a result of the Brexit process. So as I mentioned, there's a bill within Parliament, but there's also a much higher profile maybe here for trade issues than there have been for many years, because it's all part of the debate that that is happening now around around Brexit and what the UK's approach would be. And I think that does give us an opportunity to actually have some of these discussions about, as I was saying, what do we actually want out of our trade policy? And to me, it's not just the opportunity, but actually, if I feel it's vitally important that we do this, because looking around the world, we see the situations where those who feel that they're losing out and they have lost out consistently, the anger that grows. And if we can't find some progressive and more constructive approaches to changing the ways in which we do things like trade policy that people have developed a lot of anger about, that anger goes into very worrying directions. So it's really important that we do actually have this discussion and try and find solutions and maybe have some slightly different conversations from the ones that we've been having.
And Rob, last question to you. The Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, TTIP as it's called, I think probably burnt a lot of people's fingers. And in the end, after years of negotiation, got kicked into the long grass. How do we avoid TTIP 2? In new negotiations, the UK, US are talking about a potential deal, lots of opportunities to do trade deals around the emerging markets and so on. How do we avoid that situation happening again?
Well, in that case, Chris, we have a situation where we had a change in administration and leadership in this government that had a very kind of different approach to trade, and I think that impacted the change you said with regard to TTIP. So, it's hard to tell, find some specific approach that is going to avoid that in the future, because you could always have another change in leadership here. I think that it's a question of just trying to sit down and, as we're doing sort of in our NAFTA negotiation now, we're having a discussion among the governments on how do we modernize this agreement, how do we, what are the interests of each party that have changed over the years, and see what we can come up with. And I would suggest that the same would be true in any kind of negotiation of, say, the U.S. and the U.K., that we just have to sort of sit down and really talk through what are their priorities and where are the the common interests that can move that forward in reaching some sort of agreement.
Okay, well, thank you very much both for the time you've spent talking to us today. This obviously isn't going to be solved today. It's part of a dialogue and a conversation. So thank you very much, and have a nice day, and we'll speak
Thanks,
again
Rob.
Soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob.